No matter what you call it, cannabis or ganja or pot or marijuana, the federal law is plain. It is illegal. Some states are pushing back against that, and for some folks in pain or folks with an illness, that's vitally important. Cannabis has a wide range of benefits to a wide range of folks. This is a podcast in part about the benefits of cannabis, but also a podcast about how the world of plants as healing agents, can't say medicine, have changed the landscape of wellness. The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 154.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. Which is worse, child abuse with masks or indoctrination by the state? Is your school district or state mandating masks on kids this year? You still have time to put an end to that madness for yourself and your kids, and start homeschooling with my affiliate, the Ron Paul Curriculum. The courses cover all the core basics you would expect without the Marxism. There are courses also that teach about money and economics. Students do right every day, and they learn to start an online business. Give your kids a boost and give yourself some sanity with the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. Use my link, culinarylibertarian.com/homeschool, to learn more. Rachel Kennerly is my guest today. Rachel started podcasting with her Cannabis Healed Me podcast. She has grown to add the Just Add Liberty podcast, but I wanted to talk to Rachel about her view of cannabis and how it has changed over the course of doing her show, and what her views on cannabis used to be. Hello, Rachel. Thanks for joining me today on the Culinary Libertarian Podcast.
It's my pleasure, Dan. It's fun to do this.
Well, we'll see about the fun part. No, I'm kidding. It'll be fun.
I'm an optimistic person, Dan. It's going to be fun. I'm also kind of bossy, so it's going to be fun.
I gotcha. All right. Very good. So it sounds like a mother to me.
Indeed.
Before we get into the topic, which is cannabis, let's give me a bit of your background. And I'm kind of tipping my hand a little bit, but I don't know anything. So I want you to tell me how you came to be in this cannabis space and also a little bit of just what you do.
Well, once upon a time, I was a neocon Republican conservative and totally bought the Just Say No to Drugs of the 1980s. So it wasn't until like 2016 where I started on this path to trying to learn a little more, because I thought our options, you know, because there's only two options in the presidential elections. And I thought that the two options that were available to me in 2016 were both pretty disgusting. And so that sent me down a path trying to find someone, anyone else, to save this country, you know, because only the president can save the country. And I saw the Libertarian Party, and Gary Johnson was a joke. And so I just was like, well, I don't know what I'll do this year. I'll just, you know, vote for NOTA. But, you know, that's not available in presidential elections. So it just kind of sent me down this path, and I wound up running across some people that had very different ideas from mine. And I started rethinking a lot of my previous misconceptions, and then had an opportunity presented to me to go to work because I'm an accountant by trade, and then had an opportunity presented to me to go into the cannabis accounting field. And, you know, in this process of relearning a lot of the things that I thought I knew, I learned about this plant that, like I said, I had totally bought the narrative in my Just Say No program at school. And I thought it was the devil's lettuce, and that, you know, you smoke it and you turn into an axe murderer. And then I find out that there are actually medicinal properties, and there are people who are healed every day by this plant. And so the opportunity to go into this field and work in cannabis accounting, since I come from this Just Say No background, I felt like it would behoove me to learn more about the plant. And so I started talking to people about their medical cannabis stories and just learned about what an amazing gift this is. And it's all been, I guess, downhill from there. And I live in a conservative part of Texas. I know everybody thinks Texas is conservative, but they've never been to Austin. So it's very conservative in the part of the state I live in, which is in East Texas, which is, you know, dark red maroon, and not just because the Aggies are close by. So it was very conservative here. And so I started talking about this, and I really thought I would get a lot of pushback from my conservative Christian friends. And I'm a Christian as well. So I have gotten, pushback from family members. But I really thought I'd get a lot of pushback from my friends and neighbors on Facebook. And to my surprise, a lot of them would reach out to me privately and say, hey, I've had people that I know that have used this. I've used this and have found that it's beneficial to me. So I think it's not as horrible as everybody thinks it is, but just a lot of people, especially here, are afraid to talk about it. So,
you know, I think that people are afraid to talk about anything that goes against what their indoctrination was, which is what mm-hmm. you just said. You know, it's the whole, do they still have the DARE program?
I think so. And here's a funny thing. I went to a women's conference at our church today, and a lady I was sitting with, I won't say what her name is, she works for the Alcohol Drug Abuse Council here in Angelina County. And it was so hard for me to sit there. And she works with the kids, so her part of the program is to go in there and, you know, tell kids Just Say No and whatever else they tell people. And I'm like, you know that meme where you get that teenage kid whose face is completely and totally red?
Yeah.
Well, that was me trying to suppress, screaming out in a women's church conference, all drugs should be legal. Your job should not exist.
So good for you and your restraint at the women's council at the church. That was,
yes.
You get bonus points for that.
I almost hurt my arm patting myself on the back for remaining silent.
That was good. I just want to make the comment. I think it's a fairly rare person, a fairly rare trait to really examine, if not the whole of your political philosophy or whatever other, I mean, not just politics, but whatever your convictions are, just to find a reason to give you pause to say, you know, maybe that's not so. I think that's rare. And maybe I'm just not around the right people. Maybe it's not rare. I don't know. But it seems, and at least the people I've been around with for half a century, that's a fairly uncommon thing. One, because it's hard. It's mm-hmm. not at all easy. It's much easier to just toe the line and say, this is it, because it doesn't require effort. And I made the comment a couple of podcast episodes ago that when a person engages in self-reflection and self-examination, the first real great risk is, I might not like what I find. And wow. And then when that happens, now, because it's the self, you, I think, are compelled to do something about that. And it's, again, it's a whole lot easier for stasis than for change. And so thumbs up to you, two thumbs up to you for for doing that. Because it's, I mean, in either, religion might be harder, I don't know, I don't want to go down that hole, but certainly in politics or political kinds of discussions, which would be, you know, Morodes or, and I remember the whole Nancy Reagan, I was in high school, Just Say No, mm-hmm. the right dress. So anyway, that's just, I think that that's a really valuable component for anyone to have. And anyone who doesn't, who's thinking, how can I improve myself? Not because we want you to, not because anybody else wants you to, but because you think there may be something better. This is the didactic portion, which it wasn't really intended to be, but find a way to question your assumptions, not your beliefs. That's another story, and that's possible, but question your assumptions, because maybe someone told you the wrong thing for a nefarious reason, and that's putting a lot of pressure on, but that's enough of that. So the cannabis, you found out through this accounting that there's more to pot, we're going to call it. So there's more to cannabis than just the guy, hey, bud, you know, in 10th grade selling a nickel bag or whatever. And that's probably where most of our experience came from, is junior high and high school. But now there's more to it. And in the course of the last 5 years, 10 years, we've got kratom, and I may be speaking out of my depth here, but CBD, and I heard something else recently advertised. And so there's a whole bunch of things being extracted from this plant for either recreational getting high or legitimate medicinal purposes. So from this accounting thing, you started a podcast. So tell me about what was the, I think you covered that, but is there more to why you decided a podcast was something you wanted to pursue about what cannabis does, and what was the name of the show?
Well, the name of the show was Cannabis Heals Me. And I guess the point was really twofold. The point was for me to learn more about the plant. And then also, too, it was also to build credibility in the space, that I wasn't just somebody coming in to fleece all these cannabis business owners, that I was really truly invested in this more than just trying to get money from them to do their accounting. So it was kind of a twofold purpose. And what I ended up finding is that I enjoyed doing the podcast more than I did enjoyed accounting for cannabis, because it's accounting for cannabis is like nothing I'd ever done before. You know, I will say, you know, in reference to your, you know, somebody trying to sell you a dime bag in school, the DARE program totally overprepared me for being able to just say no, because I can honestly say that it wasn't until probably the last 2 years that anyone has even ever offered me any illegal substance to put into my body. We went to Jamaica and I didn't even get offered pot in Jamaica. I was so disappointed. I'm like, surely some rando is going to walk up to me in Jamaica Mon and offer me, you know, a J. But no, no.
What a disappointment.
I know. I was so totally overprepared for this my whole life. It's like, you know, they spent all this time telling me to just say no, and they never taught me about economics and taxes and all that. But I don't want to get too far afield here. But the cool thing, like I said, as I learned more about this plant and about cannabis accounting, I really found that I liked talking to patients about how they use cannabis medically more than I did the actual accounting. Because one of the hurdles that is faced by people in this industry, because it's still federally illegal, they can't bank at Bank of America. They can't go down and open a bank account, because that's a nationally chartered bank. The only places that they can actually bank are at state chartered banks or at like credit union, like local credit unions, nothing that's associated with nationally chartered or anything like that, because it's still illegal on a federal level. And then when they do get a bank account at the local bank, if they can get one, it's very expensive for them to open an account. They may have minimum fees of like $1,000 a month. And on top of that, they have to pay the bank like 2% of their deposits to keep this account open. So it's very costly for them to open a bank account. So a lot of cannabis companies just operate with cash. And so people would call me and say, hey, I've got to pay my payroll tax deposits. Well, normally you can do that electronically through electronic funds transfer through the IRS. Well, if you can't get a bank account, you can't make your payroll tax deposits electronically. You actually have to make an appointment and go down and meet with someone at the local IRS office or the state IRS office so that you can make those payroll tax deposits in cash. So they would call me and ask me, hey, how do I do this? Because I got to pay it with cash. And you know, I've been in accounting since, you know, 2000. I've been a licensed CPA since 2011. And so they would come and they would ask me these questions. And I would be like, I don't know. I'm going to have to get back to you on that because I've not ever tackled that in my career. Because every other client that I'd had could operate a checking account. And I could tell them, oh, you do da 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 da, and no problem whatsoever. But it, when we're operating in this environment where you can't get a bank account because you either can't afford it or the banks are like, we can't take any more cannabis clients, it's new territory.
Were those fees that any business would pay, or is it fees specifically for cannabis because of what?
It was specifically for cannabis because there's additional reporting on the bank's side. Anytime you have transactions over $10,000, the bank has to make a report and send that into the feds. It's an old money laundering thing. And really, honestly, you know, $10,000 in cash, when you're talking about someone who's working in the cannabis industry, it's not a huge sum of money. Obviously, if we lost $10,000, it would be devastating. But, you know, $10,000 in a day is not that much money for someone in the cannabis space, you know, as far as sales go. So every time you make a deposit for more than $10,000, the bank has to fill out this form and then send it into the IRS. Anytime you receive cash from a client, from someone over $10,000, you would have to make this report to the bank because it's about money laundering. And so there's additional reporting on the bank side. You know, ordinarily, an ordinary business account, you know, you may pay $10 a month, $25 a month. Some of them you can even get free checking with a business checking account. But these cannabis businesses are paying way more than that. Like I said, there's some that have monthly fees of like $1,000 a month plus 2 or 3% of your deposits, because they've got all this extra layer of reporting that they have to do to the federal government and probably the state entities as well.
There's a couple of really not funny jokes in there. Without the government, who would extort the cannabis industry?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, for people who can do it, it sounds like there's a market for some banking there, but that's well outside of my skill set or anything else.
There is, because that's a huge concern because you don't want to be sitting on this tons of cash.
No, that's
so then when you can't get a bank account, then you've got to have some way to protect this cash. And so you've got the security that you have to pay to be there, like people to transport it to the places where your money can be secured. That's not a bank. I mean, it's a huge industry and of just trying to be able to operate a completely cash business. And there's also huge implications, you know, there's huge opportunities for criminals to come in and rob from these. And the horrific thing is, because of the way the tax structure is set up, is that, so say, you know, robbers come in and steal $15,000 in cash from you. That's not tax deductible if you're a cannabis business owner. That's just a complete and total wash. And the way the tax laws are written, cannabis businesses have a lot of their deductions are not tax deductible. So they may actually operate at a loss. So if you run their accounting and look at their P&L, they actually operate on a loss. But then when you make the tax adjustments, they end up having to pay tax on having a loss for the year.
Oh, man.
It's really pretty awful. So, I mean, if somebody's getting into the cannabis space, it may take years for you to actually realize a profit after taxes, and you may wind up operating for several years at a loss and then still have to pay taxes on top of that. So it's important for anybody getting into this space to have some pretty healthy cash reserves on hand.
It's kind of like the restaurant business. You need some serious capitalization just because it's going to take a while. Since crypto probably circumvents the need for an accountant, maybe you don't know, but is crypto a possibility for these businesses, or is that not obviously a bad choice?
No, crypto is a possibility for the business, but then you've got another layer of tax implications for using crypto, like accepting crypto is not too bad, but then when you turn around and use the crypto to pay for expenses, because the IRS, the US government, doesn't recognize cryptocurrency as an actual currency. They consider it an investment. So when you receive crypto as income, that's no big deal. But then when you go around and say you're a dispensary and you accept cryptocurrency. Well, when you go to pay to buy product from your growers, then when you send that cryptocurrency to them, it's as though you've sold a stock, and then you've got to recognize either a capital gain or a capital loss from the redemption of that cryptocurrency. And so then you've got your cannabis accounting that you have to deal with, and then you have cryptocurrency taxes that you have to deal with on top of that.
And probably pay somebody to manage all that stuff.
Absolutely. And it's pretty expensive because the industry is complicated as far as the tax structure goes. And so most cannabis companies end up having to pay quite a bit to have someone who is specialized in this field to do the accounting and tax work for them. You know, in the gold rush, all the people that really made the money were not the guys out there panning for gold. It was the people selling the shovels and the people selling the pans. Well, that's the same thing in the cannabis space. It's really the services outside the accounting or outside of the cannabis industry that really makes more money than the people in the cannabis space themselves. So, you know, you've got the lawyers that are providing services to the cannabis industry, the people that are providing packaging, you know, any of those cannabis adjacent businesses that don't have to deal with the laws and regulations related to cannabis because they're not actually touching the product and their services are considered, you know, completely legal and the normal tax laws apply to them. They make a lot more money than do the people actually handling the product or growing the product.
Actually, that's something, if I had thought just a little bit about it, would have made sense to me, but there's probably loads of ancillary businesses that are impacted by this, and you don't always think about the packaging guy or, you know, whatever else. Interesting.
Yeah, because I had a client, and that's what she said. She said, in hindsight, she said, instead of getting into this processing, what I should have done was made my business about packaging and selling packaging to the cannabis industry. She said, if I had it to do over again, she said, that's what I would do. Because then it's just plain old manufacturing. Whereas if you've got manufacturing and you're actually touching product, then you introduce a whole layer of complicated tax mess.
Yeah. And without the government, who would screw up our lives?
Exactly. I mean, we do a good enough job of that on our own. We
don't need help
from the federal government.
I'm highly efficient at messing up my life. I don't need anybody else's help. I'm the expert at that. When you started your show and started talking to your guests about, so there's a couple things. First, you talked to two people about how cannabis was, I don't want to say curing because we're going to get the FDA all upset.
Right.
But certainly either managing the symptoms, which is sometimes really, really important, or eliminating the complication. As you started to get into this, what sort of, is revelation too strong a word? That might be. I'm going to stick with it. What sort of revelations did you have about what's possible for this plant? And then one or two really like, wow, this is an amazing story. I can't believe this thing did this for this person.
Well, one of the things I learned about that I'd never even heard of is that we have in our body, we have an endocannabinoid system. And we have receptors in our body that the plant will just like plug into. You know, we have like C1 and maybe I'm thinking of something else. I don't know. But we have actually receptors in our body that the cannabinoids can plug into. So you've got receptors in the brain, and you've got receptors in other organs of your body. And so a lot of times what happens with people that are having, you know, we hear a lot about autoimmune disorders. And it seems like a lot of these autoimmune disorders are really just deficiencies in the endocannabinoid system, where, you know, this plant has been banned for 90 years. And, you know, hemp used to be part of the diet of the animals. That's not really made more. So you would get this stuff, you know, our body can create can create its own cannabinoids, but then, you know, sometimes we need some output, outside input. And so a lot of the people I've spoken to are people that had autoimmune disorders. And then when they started feeding their body, their endocannabinoid system with cannabis, these autoimmune disorders kind of cleared up, you know, people with like irritable bowel syndrome and things like this, they would start feeding the endocannabinoid systems and their issues would resolve. Now, most people, it's not like I take it and then I'm, you know, it's not like a course of antibiotics. You take it for 10 days and then you're done. Mm-hmm. Normally they continue to take it. And as a way to continue to supplement their endocannabinoid system. And I have no medical background. So, you know, a lot of this stuff is kind of beyond my comprehension and ability to really relay effectively, unfortunately, because I don't have that background. But, you know, we've got this plant and like I said, this endocannabinoid system that we have in our body. I mean, it wasn't even discovered until like the 80s. There's this doctor over in Israel, Rafael Meshulam, and he's done a lot of research on this plant and on the endocannabinoid system. And there's new cannabinoids that are found in the plant all the time. And the receptors in our body, we're finding new ones for that. And we've just barely touched the tip of the iceberg on this thing. And they can't do the research in America because cannabis is still considered a Schedule I drug, which means it's, you know, the worst of the worst. And because they have different things. They have like different levels. They have like Schedule I, Schedule II, Schedule III, and Schedule IV. And I think cannabis is actually higher on the chart than I think heroin. I think heroin may be like a Schedule II, but cannabis is Schedule I. So it's supposed to be worse than that.
It's not.
It's really quite shocking because there has never been a recorded death related to cannabis. Now, there have been things that have been reported saying, oh, so-and-so took this cannabis product and they died. And typically what happened is that cannabis was tainted or maybe the oil that was used in it was bad, but it wasn't the cannabis plant itself that killed someone, because it's there's no cannabinoid receptors in the brainstem that has to do with like the functions in your body where your heart beats or your lungs work. So even if you get completely stoned out of your mind and have an experience that it feels like you might die, but you won't actually die because your body is going to, the heart's going to continue to beat. You're going to continue to breathe. So because there's no receptors in the brainstem that controls those autonomous functions in the body.
With the understanding that you aren't a doctor and don't have medical mm-hmm. training and barely even play a doctor on the radio, can you at least explain or address a little bit, what does it mean, endocannabinoid?
There's just a system in our body that has these receptors that the endocannabinoid, everybody has at this point has heard of CBD oil.
Right.
Okay. CBD is a cannabinoid in the cannabis plant. And so CBD, a lot of people have found healing just using CBD oil. And what the CBD is doing, it's going in, it's plugging into this endocannabinoid system and helping your body heal itself, basically. And there's other cannabinoids in the plant. There's like THC, which is the cannabinoid that makes people feel high. And then they're finding new cannabinoids every day. There's, you know, CBG, a ton of them that I can't even think of all their names right now. And because, again, you know, research has been limited on what they can do on this. So it has to be outsourced to other countries. And the doors are starting to open a little bit in the United States, but still not, we're still not able to do the level of research that they're doing, like I said, over in Israel. And I think the United States actually funds some of the research in Israel instead of just doing it here. Yeah, we fund it. We fund some other country to do it.
I'm kind of, there's a visual, and I'm just trying to see if I can get this picture at least close to right, even if it's just at the basic elementary level, where when people were trying to explain to me histamine versus antihistamine, and so there's this little space carved out in the shape of, say, a square. Mm-hmm. And then you have round and oval and rectangle and square, and the square fits into that space in this cell and completes the cell. So it sounds, as crude as that is, kind of what you're explaining is that there's this receptor is a place for something that fits, mm-hmm. and the exact thing that fits in the endocannabinoid system is in the cannabinoids in the plant, and then whatever that cell was that was incomplete is now complete and does whatever it is it does. Is that?
I think that's probably a pretty good expert, better than I've done. I've done a terrible job.
I don't really know what I said.
You bring
me
on as somebody who's supposed to know about cannabis, and I can't even explain the endocannabinoid system.
Well, that was outside the scope. That's all right.
But, you know, most doctors don't know what the endocannabinoid system is because it's not something that's
learning.
Taught. Yeah, it's not taught in medical schools today. Now, I had a nurse practitioner on, it's been probably a year or two ago, and they're actually starting to teach some of this material in nursing programs to talk about the endocannabinoid system. As this becomes legal in more and more states, they're actually starting to introduce this, and I think they're actually going to have questions related to endocannabinoid system on the NCLEX, which is what nurses have to pass, the test they have to pass in order to get their license. So, right. so they are actually introducing this on a level where the nurses will learn about it. But I don't know if any of the medical schools are planning on introducing this to doctors.
Well, it sounds like the nutrition that's quote unquote air quotes taught in medical
right.
school. It's
right.
It's pretty much the here's the MyPlate schedule, and as long as you know that, then you've passed your nutrition. But sorry, that doesn't count at all.
Right.
So you brought up Schedule 1, 2, 3, and 4, and I didn't know there was mm-hmm. a 4. I knew there was 1 and 2. I sort of have a little bit of a guess. I know what the answer is, but I want you to talk about who was the person that really worked to vilify the cannabis plant as this evil thing, and then pinpointed a specific group of people as those who use it, and then how did it come to be the FDA's prime candidate of offense?
Well, this kind of started back in the 20s and 30s, and Harry Anslinger was the guy who vilified cannabis. He was, I call him the godfather of cannabis prohibition, and he had worked for the U.S. government. He worked in the department during prohibition of alcohol. Well, once prohibition of alcohol ended, you've got these federal agents sitting around that are no longer employed. And God forbid we lay off any federal employees.
Oh, no,
so
no.
I think, you know, this is probably, maybe I'm being too conspiratorial, but I'm like, you know, so Harry Anslinger's like, well, I need to find some way to stay employed and stay on the payroll here. And so I think he started looking around and found cannabis. And he's the one that actually started calling it marijuana. He you know, because then he could, it sounded foreign because it was from those crazy Mexicans. And so he started calling it marijuana instead of cannabis, because people knew what cannabis was, but they didn't know what this scary sounding marijuana that sounds like it's from those Mexicans was. And so he was able to go in and get them to pass legislation to make it illegal. And there was a doctor that went in and said, look, this is a plant. It's actually the cannabis plant was actually in the U.S. Pharmacopoeia until like 1939 or 1942, something like that. So it was used. All these miraculous things that we're discovering that the cannabis plant can do, like stop seizures and reduce pain. These miraculous things that we're now discovering or have discovered in the last 10 years, they knew this back in the 30s and 40s because it was in the pharmacopoeia. So these aren't new discoveries for this plant. They existed 90 years ago. We just got told that it didn't have any medicinal use. And that's what, you know, Schedule One means, is that the definition is that they have no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. And I was wrong. Heroin is actually still considered a Schedule One, but there was, cocaine. Cocaine is Schedule Two and heroin is Schedule One and marijuana, cannabis is Schedule One, but cocaine is Schedule Two.
And what parallel universe does that even make sense?
It doesn't. And especially since the definition says there's no currently accepted medical use.
Well, then we should put sugar on Schedule One.
Right. Absolutely. And there's definitely a high potential for addiction there.
And abuse.
Uh-huh.
Yep. And certainly no medical relevant use.
No.
Except to make you unwell.
Right. Right. But cannabis. And that's why it's preposterous that it's a Schedule One drug, because there are a host of medical uses for it. And like I said, it was on the U.S. Pharmacopeia.
So somebody's making serious bank keeping this on Schedule One.
You know, if this weren't Schedule One and people were able to use it medicinally, it would eliminate the need for a lot of pharmaceuticals. And, you know, we in U.S. history, we learned how awful the robber barons were. Rockefeller and whoever the other ones were. But I think really the worst thing they did, other than offering cheap steel to people, the worst thing they did is they went in and took over the medical establishment. They basically, you know, started making all these contributions and to the medical schools, and then essentially got to write the curriculum. And so any schools that focused on holistic health, they didn't get funded, so they went out of business. And so instead of them being terrible because they were the robber barons, they were terrible because they got all this money and then went over and basically took over the medical field. And we have what we have now, a lot less healthy population.
Now, that is an interesting story. And I don't think I even knew that part. So that's, we're going to have to talk about that at some other point. But that's.
Well, I'm not super. Super whatever on it. Like I couldn't like teach a course on it or anything like right. that. And, but I mean, you know, I don't know what it is about people when they get tons of money, they just turn into Mr. Burns. And I feel like that, you know, we're seeing that now with people like Bill Gates. You know, they suddenly turn into eugenicists who think they should control the world.
Yeah. I don't know what that is either, but that's probably a perfect reference. So there, you mentioned something about states where it's legal. So this is an interesting talking point on several levels. One, it's, as you mentioned, it's still at the federal level is illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So our friend Michael Bolton at the 10th Amendment Center has really made the case that the cannabis folks, more than the 2A guy, people,
mm-hmm.
More than, well, probably anybody. But so they have worked so hard at effectively nullifying federal law at the state level. And then I think, if I'm right, tell me if this is not right, some states have made cannabis legal, maybe with restrictions for either medical or not medical, but they have just said, you know what? They're doing it. Let's just let them do it with maybe restrictions. So we have effectively nullification, which is exactly what should be happening.
Right.
Is that part, did I get it right?
Yeah. I mean, really, honestly, the sad thing to me is this, if states don't legalize it as a big F you to the federal government. That's not why most states legalize it. Most states legalize it because they see it as a cash cow at this point. And as much as, now I don't know if that's the way it started out, but that's certainly, I think, that's always the argument that is made. Oh, we're missing all these dollars because we haven't legalized this cannabis. You know, when it's like, it's frustrating to me as someone who loves liberty, that government steals our natural rights from us, and then they turn around and sell them back to us and use it to fund the very entity that has thrown people in cages over a plant for 90 years.
And then so demand you thank them for their magnanimity.
Exactly, exactly. Oh, we need to get down and bow to our wonderful liberators who still have people in prison serving life sentences for cannabis at this point, which is the sad thing. There, where cannabis is legal in California, there's still people serving life sentences over cannabis in California today. And so, I mean, it's not, I think it's great that they have nullified, but like I said, at this point, it's not because they're nullifying so that they can stick it to the federal government or that they really believe in states' rights. They're doing it because they want money. And they need, so they're going to get it off the backs of sick people.
Yeah, that's it's tough to applaud that. Although I think there is something applause worthy about nullifying federal law because the backside of that is it's hurting a lot of people while it's probably helping some people. So that's. Yeah, welcome to government. You know, we have on our show as a crossover guest, Robin Lawrence, who wrote the Cannabis Cookbook. I think Robin, in her own way, was an activist, might be the right word, for cannabis. But her focus was to get the benefits, but let's use them in cooking. And so I interviewed her. I learned a lot about what you can and can't do. You can't actually heat it above a certain temperature. Otherwise, it's just green stuff. And so that's not taking on the man in some straight on way, but it's sort of on the side. We're going to work to nullify or just invalidate laws. Do you see other of your guests being activists in a kind of less obvious way, pushing for, I guess, maybe politics has ruined the word reform, but it is it's kind of the word that fits, pushing for reform, pushing for maybe education. Maybe the thing is to just educate people and get them out of the just say no / dare propaganda to say, you know, it's okay if you don't want it, but at least make the decision that recognize it isn't the horror you were told. And so someone who's doing something voluntary that doesn't harm you actually doesn't harm you.
Most of my guests that have been willing, I mean, if they're willing to come on my show and talk about it, then they're typically outspoken activists on behalf of the plant because, you know, this is a plant that was given to us and we should have, we do have a natural right to treat our body and to even put things into our body that are harmful to us. I mean, nobody comes up to me and slaps a cheeseburger out of my hand and says, you're going to have a heart attack. And I'm going to have to pay for your medical costs related to your heart attack because of your insurance. So nobody's doing that to me. And that hamburger's far worse than me, far worse for me than smoking some marijuana or cannabis, however you want to do it. So most everyone that's come on my show is willing to speak out and to advocate on behalf of the plant. I mean, if they're willing to come on a podcast and talk about it, they're willing to go in front of state houses and representatives. And most of the people, I mean, a lot of the people I've spoken to, they have children and they're using this plant to treat their children who are maybe they're autistic and they self-harm, you know, they bite themselves until they're bleeding and they, give this plant to their child and they no longer self-harm. Or maybe they have a daughter who has Tourette's and cannot attend school any longer because her they're not seizures, but convulsions are so bad she can't sit in a seat. And she will stay up all night just doing like this with her body, just convulsing. And, you know, she has rock hard abs, not because she does a bunch of crunches, but because her body convulses to the point where, you know, she can't sleep. She can't attend school. And then they give her this plant that they've been told will turn her into an axe murderer. And now all of a sudden she can attend school. She started college this year and is attending college. You know,
that's awesome.
And previous to that, she couldn't even attend high school because her convulsions were so disruptive to the classroom. So a lot of the people that I've spoken to are parents advocating on behalf of their children, and they're doing so at great risk because right. There's always the possibility that they could be thrown in prison, you know, thrown in jail because they're acknowledging that, yes, I am giving this to my child. So they could be thrown in jail for that because it's illegal. And a lot of these people are in states where it's not legal. They're like, hey, you know, when it comes down to your kids, picking between your kids and man's law, my kid's going to win out 100% of the time.
Right.
Man's law can go jump off a cliff. I'm going to give my child what my child needs to be well. And that's what these parents feel like. So they're under risk of being thrown in jail themselves. They're also at risk of Child Protective Services coming in and taking their child from them. And so these are very real risks that they take, but they see their friends suffering or their friends' children suffering. And they want people to know that, hey, we've got a plant that God put on this earth that has what we need in a lot of instances to bring healing to our bodies. And they hate seeing the people suffering and dying because they're given pharmaceuticals as opposed to let's try a plant first.
Yeah. There's the old ways with cannabis being in the pharmacopoeia. I probably said that the wrong way, but the phrase "we" is just so ruined. Known by people 100 years ago, both in medicine with cannabis and with food and nutrition, seems mostly gone. We, for a variety of reasons, and as of this recording, today's podcast was about raw milk. And we had a little bit of a conversation about how, instead of taking the raw milk, science wants to find out what the magic part is of raw milk, separate it out, put it into a tablet, and sell that to you, as if somehow the thing in the tablet was the magic, when actually it was the whole process of going and getting the raw milk and having an active lifestyle and not being a couch potato that... Mm-hmm. is the magic. That's not magic at all. And there seems to be a lot of similarity between medicine that is not allowed, the cannabis plant, and there's probably more. If it's not allowed, it's something we don't know about. Everybody who's watching or listening to this probably has seen that Facebook ad for the Lost Ways book, and there's a weed that grows in your yard that it takes a little bit of effort, but from that weed, you can make a painkiller. Mm-hmm. And it's right in your front yard. You just need a lot of it and cook it down for a while and make a syrup and voila, I don't know. So we're back to that quip: without the federal government, who would deny us our medicine in the form of naturally occurring things like raw milk or kefir or raw cheese or cannabis? And I feel like Ron Paul asking, when are the people going to wake up? And the answer usually is never. But I don't know. And Ron's got a bigger audience than I do. And if he can't get it done, I'm not giving myself the credit, but it's a frustration that this has come to be, that this is the way, that the things that worked are eschewed, I know time hates the word, as almost folksy witchcraft, just craziness. Mm-hmm. And if it just gets crazy. It just spins out of control. And now we have, you know, who's the science denier? Well, it's too much.
Well, and that's the thing with cannabis. You know, when you go to the state houses and you lobby on behalf of getting this plant legalized, they're like, there's just not enough science. There's not enough science. Well, that's because there's not U.S. studies. And the reason there aren't U.S. studies is because this is a Schedule I drug and they can't do the studies here. So you provide them when in the last legislative session, the people like with Texas Normal and Texans for Responsible Marijuana Policy, they take to the state representatives and state senators a binder that's like 2 to 3 inches thick of all the medical studies that have been done around the world that proves that this plant has medicinal benefits. And then they still get up on the state house floor and argue against it and say there's not enough studies, which is complete and total hogwash. There are studies, they just refuse to look at them. And I think it all comes down to, like most things do with control, it comes down to control. I knew, you know, I was really hopeful in 2019 because there were 60 some odd bills that were presented related to cannabis, you know, legalizing cannabis here in the state of Texas. 60
bills?
Yeah, 60 some odd bills that were introduced. And so I
was. Seems like a lot.
It is a lot for Texas. Okay. I mean, it's a conservative state. Some of them were similar, some of them were better than others, but you know, 60 some odd bills being introduced, it seemed, I was hopeful that we would get some sort of cannabis legislation passed, better than the program that we had. And then I made them, I don't know if it was a mistake or, you know, kismet, I don't know. We still have blue laws here in the state of Texas, where you can't buy alcohol at the store until noon on Sundays. And so right. I was listening to them argue. They were trying to change the time from 12 p.m. on Sundays to 10 a.m. on Sundays. So 2 hours. They were going to make it so that you could buy alcohol 2 hours earlier. And I heard state representatives get up there and argue against changing the time that you could buy alcohol on Sundays by 2 hours. And at that point, I'm like, we aren't getting legal cannabis in this legislative session.
You're killing grandma.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to hear them argue that adults should not be able to buy alcohol 2 hours earlier on a Sunday, 2 hours. And I want them to legalize cannabis. Ain't happening.
So my vision.
And that legislation failed, by the way. We still have to wait till noon on Sundays to go and buy a little tiny bottle of sweet red rind so that we can make mushrooms for our fajitas.
But the joke I have in my head, I guess maybe it could be a meme, is someone at a convenience store in Texas at 11:59 saying, "I'll take two of those revolvers and a pack case of cigarettes." But I can't have the beer. It's like, okay, well, this is plainly idiotic.
It is. One of my Facebook memories, I think yesterday, popped up because my husband, we were having fajitas one day, and we like to cook mushrooms and grilled onions to go with our fajitas. You know, we do the whole thing, guacamole, blah, blah, blah. And so he went to, and my mother-in-law, the way she makes them, she uses sweet red wine right at the end of the process. And so we were out of the little bottles of sweet red wine. So my husband, we stopped after church to pick him up. It was 11:56. He had to stand at the cash register for 4 minutes before he could buy those little tiny bottles of sweet red wine. I mean, that wasn't even enough alcohol to make my 12-year-old drunk. But he had to wait for 4 minutes to buy those bottles. He was furious. But we really love our mushrooms with our fajitas, so.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, and the grilled onions is a nice touch. I like that. I approve. So let's take a moment out for a word from Jake about his Tasting Anarchy podcast.
Hey everyone, Jake here, host of the Tasting Anarchy podcast. Join my co-host Mason and I each week as we explore the world of wine and alcohol through a Liberty lens. You can find us on all your major podcatchers, tastinganarchy.com or Tasting Anarchy on Twitter. Tasting Anarchy, your wine and liberty podcast. Find out how much government is in your drink.
Since you brought up the food, we're going, and I know, well, we're going to segue. So I know you've listened to the show at least once, so you know what's coming, even if you didn't prepare for it.
I do know what's coming, and I did not prepare for it.
Good. So this is the short answer portion of the show. Of the five flavors, sweet, salty, bitter, sour, or umami, which one's your favorite?
Okay, one, what is umami? I've heard you ask that question, and I have no idea what that means.
So you talk about mushrooms. Mushrooms, they have sort of that earthy openness to them. That's okay. Kind of what umami does.
Okay. Sour, no. What was the other one? Sweets?
Sweet, salty, bitter, salty. Umami.
Okay, bitter, definitely no. Sour, not really. Umami. I don't know. Most of the stuff I eat is not earthy. Man, I think it would probably, and I know you're probably going to hate this, but I think it's like a tie between salty and sweet, or maybe the two combined.
No, that's very good.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Okay.
What's your favorite food?
Clearly, I like it all. I think pizza. Pizza's probably my favorite. Because that was when I do keto, that's probably the thing I miss the most is being able to eat pizza. Of all that. Well, pizza and bread. But mostly, I think pizza is the thing I miss the most when I'm strictly keto.
What's your least favorite food?
Black licorice.
Oh, what gets you excited?
What gets me excited when I see other people coming around to the ideals of liberty? I'm teaching a little class. We're about to wrap it up with my son and a few of his friends. I'm doing a little class. We're going through Whatever Happened to Penny Candy by Richard Mayberry, his Uncle Eric series. And so sitting there and talking to those kids about the Fed and inflation and how inflation is terrible. That's been an awesome experience for me. And these are kids aging in range from, like, I think the youngest one is 6 and he mostly just doodles, but he pops up every now and then. I told them if any question I ask, if they answer inflation, they'll probably be right about half the time. So he'll pop up every now and then and say inflation. But the questions these kids ask are pretty, pretty cool. And so seeing the gears turning for them on monetary policy and things that most adults never ponder is pretty exciting to me.
That's pretty cool. What turns you off?
Turns me off. People that think they know it all. Because nobody knows it all. No matter, like, as someone who has rearranged most of the way I thought for my adult life, and I'll be honest with you, I think I thought I knew it all, and now that I know what I know, I don't even know that I know what I know. So I know that they don't know it all.
Put that on a mug. It reminds me of the joke, how can you the joke is, how can you spot a vegan? Wait 5 minutes, don't worry, they'll tell you. How do you spot a know-it-all? Wait 5 minutes, don't worry, they'll tell you.
Right. Yeah, I don't think you even have to wait 5 minutes with the know-it-alls. But I will say, in the defense of my friend who is a vegan, I've known her since she was a child. And I didn't know she was vegan until like a couple years ago, because she's not an obnoxious vegan. So they do exist. They're as rare as unicorns, I think. But they do exist.
They probably took her vegan card away. What sound do you love?
Ah. What sound do I love? I really should have went back and listened to these questions so I'd be prepared to answer them.
But the unprepared extemporaneous is really what people want to hear.
It is, but then you have the awkward pauses and me just talking so that I can think of something to say to you. I think I just love hearing my son and my husband laugh and play around and have a good time together, because we were married for a long time and didn't hear any of that. So to be able to hear that interaction is pretty awesome.
It's a good answer. What sound do you hate?
Whiny people.
Or the fox in the hen house. Did you get that fixed?
No comment, because I'm going to plead the fifth.
All right. Well, the whiny people answer yes. That's maybe one of the better answers I've heard. What is your favorite food indulgence?
I love a good ribeye.
What's not to love?
I know, that's my favorite, with some Worcestershire sauce on it. You probably don't. I mean, I love to drown my ribeye in Worcestershire sauce. And I had a friend, and he always made the best ribeyes. He would put them on one of those little smokies and cook them like that. Ugh, best ribeyes ever. And I've never been able to duplicate that. Of course, I outsourced the grilling to my husband. You know, because, you know, apparently you have to have more testosterone in your body to be a good griller. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay, well, I won't refute you there, but I will tell you, and now there is a really spectacular sauce to be made with Worcestershire sauce, but because this is a restaurant sauce, I know that most people don't have fresh-made beef stock. Oh, let me just go get a gallon of that.
Right.
So I realized that in the commercial stuff, it might work, but it's so lacking in collagen, which equals flavor, that it's almost not worth doing. However, since it's worth a shot and give it a try. So in a cast iron pan, well, cast iron is good, but then doesn't have to be cast iron. Give the steak a really good sear on both sides, finish it in the oven or finish it on the grill, but you want the stuff in the pan. With the stuff that's in the pan, then add maybe not more than a quarter of a cup of Worcestershire sauce. Now, here's the thing. Because it's potent, and as it boils, it's going to clear your nose. Let the steam go away. As soon as that's almost to a glaze, add a quarter of a cup of beef stock, beef broth, whatever you have. Let that come back to almost a glaze, then add half a cup of heavy cream. And let that all cook down to a sauce consistency. So with the steak bits that were in the pan, now in the sauce, and all that reduced flavor, that is an amazing steak sauce. Takes a few moments.
That sounds amazing.
But while it's cooking, your steak is resting anyway, so all the juices go back into the steak. And, well worth
doing. You had me at Worcestershire sauce and cream, so...
It's good. It really is. It's good. And eat it all. It doesn't really reheat very well. Goes good with mashed potatoes. I mean, shoelaces would probably go good with mashed potatoes. So what's the name? Come on. For people who want to learn more about this, there's lots of ways to go with this, even with the cannabis cookbook. Is there a book you think that people could read to maybe learn about Anslinger and his antics, or, I mean, is there a recommendation you have?
Well, the book that really got me rethinking the drug war is, I can't remember his name, but I remember the name of the book, Chasing the Scream by Johann Hari. That was the book that got me completely rethinking the drug war. And so I highly recommend that to anyone who still thinks we should throw people with drug problems in prison. Now, I will say it's his politics run a little further to the left than mine do, and some of his solutions are not the solutions that I would have. But I think for an examination of the drug war and a better understanding of what that looks like on for people with drug abuse problems. I think that's a great book for folks to read. Now, I bought it on Audible and listened to it on audiobook, and I will say it is not for the faint of ear. I didn't listen to it with my son within earshot because there's some language in it. But, you know, a lot of people aren't as particular about that as I am.
Right.
But I think it's still a great book.
You know, you make an interesting point. I think it's a valid point. And one, we're going to bring up Bolden again from the 10th Amendment Center. When I think that this is one of the big problems in people who want to find political answers, that it has to be 100% or nothing. There is no, mm-hmm. There's no gray area. There's no accommodation for single issue things. Mm-hmm. And the 10th Amendment Center is fabulous and fantastic for finding groups that maybe on 9 out of 10 things we would never agree on. But this one mm-hmm. thing, we agree completely on this issue, and they will work together to advance that single issue. And so the impact of the drug war is probably wildly unknown to nearly everybody, and making that information available is worth somebody whose politics may not align, because even if, now I'm preaching to you, but really it, just mm-hmm. because someone's solution to a problem doesn't agree with yours doesn't mean the identification of the problem is incorrect. And
right.
I think that's a big deal. I think that's getting that idea across, that, and we see it a lot in politics or on Twitter or Facebook. Well, oh, well, we can't like that guy because he's a blankist, whatever the thing is. And
right.
as some attempt to discount everything. Well, you know, just because your statement could possibly be true doesn't nullify the fact that his facts are right. So mm-hmm. that's...
Well, in reference to that, Alex Berenson, who was is a former New York Times, he was a former New York Times reporter. He wrote basically a propaganda piece against cannabis called Tell Your Children, which is kind of a play on the words from that the old Harry Anslinger movie, you know, the first, like one of the first movies about prohibition. So he wrote this book, Tell Your Children. And I had Chris Kelton on my podcast, and we talked about his book. And so Chris goes through and just destroys this book and lack of any evidence that Alex presented to support his position in this book. But Alex has been fantastic on lockdowns and COVID and everything. And so I'm able to see, okay, he's terrible on cannabis, but he's great on this issue here. And to me, cannabis is one of those issues. One of the things that I like about being involved in this space is that it brings everybody together. We've got Republicans, we've got Libertarians, we've got Democrats, all working towards a similar goal. Maybe our end idea of how the problem should be handled is not the same, but all working towards one goal, which is to make a plant that should never have been made illegal to begin with legal again. Now, they may see it as a cash cow and they want to tax it and use it to fund social programs. And I just want the state not to sell people back their liberties. But if we can, you know, work towards the same goal, which is let's not throw people in cages over a plant, I am 100% on board with that.
Right. I'm going to butcher the Jefferson quote about liberty is gained by inches. And that
yeah,
might
I mean,
be
every,
the thing.
Every,
Let's, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we've been getting knocked back by miles of late. Let's take the inches where we can get them.
Right. So let's make the plant free, and then we'll worry about the tax part. But that's just one right forward step at a time.
Well, and that's kind of the approach that Texas for Marijuana, Responsible Marijuana Policy have, or Texas, I think that's how it is. That's horrible that I can't remember. That's kind of the approach that they have, because a lot of, you know, pure libertarians are like, well, we don't want to have any taxes on it. And it's like, look, dude, let's just get it legal, and then we can quibble about getting rid of the taxes. We can quibble about getting rid of the regulation, which is difficult, But let's at least stop throwing people in cages over this. Let's work towards something that we can accomplish with the people we have to align ourselves with.
Right. Well, and that's the there's the difference between the armchair keyboard warrior libertarian, or probably even Democrat, Green, Republican, whatever you have, and the actual what can we get?
Yes.
And,
yes.
And there's a big difference. There's a chasm there sometimes between, you know, it's fine to have your principle, but what are you willing to concede to at least get the majority of the thing that you want in the first place? And that's a tough spot to be in. I'm not sure I'm the guy for that, but that's at least I recognize that it exists.
Right. I mean, it is difficult, but I don't think you're necessarily sacrificing libertarian principles to get it legalized and have it taxed. I mean, that's preferable to the alternative where we're paying to put people in cages over it. So it's not my ideal solution, but it's better than what we got right now. So,
So the argument would be, the retort is, well, taxation is theft. Yes.
And absolutely.
So is so many other things, but what about, yes, there's a cost to taxation. What about the cost to all those families and the cost that you're paying to support the prisons and the guards and this whole system? So it becomes pretty idiotic pretty fast to argue that taxation is theft, so we can't legalize drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But how many, I don't know, is it hundreds of thousands of people are in jail for something that shouldn't be legal, and you're being taxed to support them anyway? So shut up.
Right.
And let's work on getting this done, and we'll fix the next problem next.
Yep. Yeah, if more people would get off their duff instead of armchair quarterbacking it, we'd be a whole lot closer to liberty. And these people that say, well, I'm not going to involve myself in the political process because I don't believe in it. Well, you know what? The next time your neighbor goes to the voting booth, they're going to vote to up your property taxes. If you don't go and vote, at least defensively, which Lysander Spooner even says, hey, defensive voting is okay. If we don't get out there and vote, at least in the defensive position, they're going to vote to strip us of more liberties and strip us of more money. So the people that just sit there and argue, well, I'm waiting for my pure libertarian society. I'm a collapsitarian. It's like, well, you know, I don't want my child to live in a collapsed society. I'd prefer to, you know, maybe make it come down a little slower or a little easier.
And collapse not being,
and at least take the boot off of my neck a little bit in the process.
Right. Yeah. Collapse sounds instant.
Yeah.
As opposed to, so collapse sounds chaos and then boom, mm-hmm. it's all gone, like Haiti and the earthquake, versus structured disassembly. Definitely be behind structured disassembly, but just, I think there probably are people who are looking forward to chaotic collapse, and, you know, that's the boog folks, and, well, that's fine, but.
Right, yeah, I'm not looking forward to that. I don't think maybe they don't fully understand the implications of collapse, but
I didn't read it. I think I read something. I didn't read the book, and maybe I should, but I think there's a suggestion somewhere. I heard this, that Malice had made the comment that even at your school board meeting, you've got government.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody is setting the rules. Somebody is adhering to a time frame. And so you can't ever get away. Now, the school board meeting doesn't have the power to put you in cages or shoot you, but there is structure everywhere you go. And in the case of collapse, I'm not entirely sure that I don't want necessarily the governments coming out of that are going to come out of that, because they may decide they have the force to cage you and shoot you.
Right. I mean, they already kind of think they do now. I don't want it to get worse.
No, I don't want it to get worse. All right. Where can people find and follow you on social media?
Well, I've got to be honest. I'm kind of on a pause as far as the Cannabis Hills to Me podcast goes. It's just after all the craziness of the past 16 months, it's been more difficult for me to chase people down and interview them for the show. I think they've got bigger fish to fry. And so I'm kind of on a pause on that. But if people want to go out and check past episodes, we've got over 100 episodes out there at CannabisHealsMe.com. And then in October of last year, I started a new podcast called Just Add Liberty, where I talk more about simple ways that we can add liberty to our life, like homeschooling, self-employment. I did a recent episode on building your own town and taking over local county politics.
Sweet.
As a way of maybe getting more liberty in your life, because if you control the government, then you can control how hard the boot steps on you.
Right.
So, and then homesteading and stuff like that. So if people are interested in those type of topics, you can go out to justaddliberty.com. On social media, on Twitter, I'm the Grow CFO. And I don't post that. I'm not like a crap poster on Twitter. I mean, maybe like once or twice I'll say something that's a little spicy, but I don't have hardly any followers, so it doesn't get much traction, which is fine by me. And then on Facebook, if they want to look up Cannabis Heals Me, which will be shadow banned because cannabis is still an off topic or an off the index card word on Facebook, apparently. And then if they're interested in Just Add Liberty, they can follow that as well.
Cool.
Over on Facebook.
Well, good. Well, I will put the links to the web pages for Cannabis Heals Me and Just Add Liberty on today's show notes page, which is culinarylibertarian.com/154. Rachel, thank you for taking time out of what now is your afternoon.
Well, I appreciate the invite, Dan.
All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'll add the links to Cannabis Heals Me and Just Add Liberty, Rachel's two podcasts, to the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/154. If you like the show, I would appreciate your support at culinarylibertarian.com/support. Please share this episode on your social media feeds, and please rate and review the show on your favorite podcatcher. That helps more people find this podcast. Here's a PSA. Halloween is soon enough, and candy corn really isn't corn. The only proper thing to do with it is throw it in the trash. You're welcome. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.
I enjoy the work that you do over here, and I've enjoyed listening to the episodes that aren't always just about food, so it's kind of cool to see you kind of branch out a little bit there.
But yeah, today's is a little bit about food, a lot about politics, and interestingly, how you, dear listener, can go find in your state, possibly, some way to take back liberty. Go find a raw milk farmer.
I recently started buying raw milk from a lady here locally, and what we're trying to do locally is just build a community of people that we can depend on when SHTF. Yeah.
You know, it's, I think that's happening a lot of places, because there's a not as popular social media app for neighborhoods, and someone in that has reached out to a bunch of us for the same idea for let's build a little community in our community of people who mm-hmm. have skills and knowledge and desire to help each other when whatever comes.
Yep.
So I think that's really a good idea.
I think it's a great idea. I think we need, you know, as much as I love my internet friends, if I'm unemployed and can't afford groceries, my internet friends probably can't do a lot to help me, but my neighbor down the street with a garden can probably help me out, or they can refer people to my husband's business if they need a house built or something like that. So as much as I value my internet friends, I think it's very valuable to build local community. And, you know, we've been able to do a lot of that through church. You know, I know a lot of folks have been disrupted on that end as far as church closures and stuff like that. But, you know, that's been one of our best places to find people. I mean, not that I'm saying Christians, non-Christians should go to church just to find community. You know, maybe you'll find a little something else other than community if you do go to church, but that's been a good resource for us.
Yeah, community is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to let you run because I've got a dog that needs attending to.
Okay. So. Poor little guy. He's been like an hour and a half with nobody to pet him.
He's a 60-pound-year-old puppy, and that is an eternity to him. And he loves his humans. He does. He does.
Yeah, right. I saw the cat earlier, and he or she did not seem the least bit concerned that you weren't paying attention.
No, she didn't care. Yes, and you're a human, piss off. Where's my food, human? Meow.
Other right, that, exactly.